You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to our Wednesday release of the podcast where I'm talking about Bitcoin. On today's show, we bring back by popular demand, Dr. Adam Back, who's the CEO and founder of Blockstream. And we also have Plan B, who's the creator of the Stock the Flow model. On the show, we talk about the broader macro implications of Bitcoin reaching a market cap in excess of $1 trillion, but still having market corrections of $500 billion. We talk about Chinese mining news. We talk about energy concerns and highlights. Additionally, we talk about the derivatives market and how it had an impact on the recent sell-off. So if you're looking for a good update from two of the smartest guys in the space, hang on tight, because here we go.
You're listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Like we said in the introduction, I'm here with Adam Back and Plan B. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so where I want to start this off, I've done a lot of thinking as this price has just gotten punished over the last 2 months, month and a half or whatever it is. And one of the things at the top of the list is just systematic risk. A few months back, we saw Wall Street Bets do the whole GME thing, and it had, you know, just a small kind of pittance of a market cap. But the implications of that were massive. So you had Melvin Capital, the Citadel had to come up with $2 billion. You had 0.72 asset management. All of them were just, you know, it created a mess in the financial markets. You saw the broader markets selling off through some of this. And, you know, it was only a $6 billion loss all around. But the implications of what you saw that this created in the overall market was kind of crazy. So when I think about Bitcoin having a market cap, it was well over $1 trillion, and it has a 50% drop in price. And so we're talking $500 billion, and that's just Bitcoin alone. What in the world does this mean long term when we, think about the implications of the price potentially being higher? Maybe a Bitcoin price of 100,000. What would that mean for systematic risk? At what point is Bitcoin potentially wagging the tail of the regular market and how they're going to have to respond with further liquidity? Is this something you guys have given much thought to?
Well, I think the Bitcoin market has some very high volatility, and it's just part of the market. And I find it really funny that we all knew at the beginning of the bull market that we would not go up in a straight line and that there would be multiple minus 35 or minus 50% drops along the way, like it did in the 2017 and 2013 bull run. So now we have one, our first minus 35% dip month to month. And it feels like this is new and upsetting everything and changing everything, but it's not. It's at least in my opinion, it's just a normal thing that is present in a market like Bitcoin that has also the returns that go with those high volatility. And we should expect those drops and not be afraid of them, make use of them. And, psychology is different because it feels like Bitcoin is dead every time. Mm-hmm. But you know there will be another minus 50% drop and a minus 35% drop. So I don't think that structurally anything has changed. It's just part of the buildup, part of the growth of this market and part of the charm of this market as well. Because you cannot have 200% annualized returns without volatility. And to be honest, minus 35% versus a plus 200% annualized return is still a bargain deal.
Yeah. But I guess where I'm getting at is once we achieve a certain market cap in size, it's almost like Bitcoin starts to become this thing that's going to drive central banking policy because it's so substantially large and it has so much volatility. Because I don't think, you know, if we go to, let's just say the market cap goes to something like $5 trillion and it's starting to become competitive with gold, I still think the volatility is going to be there. I don't think the volatility is going to wane at that point. I think you're still going to have aggressive volatility. And if true, and the market cap would be something of that magnitude, doesn't this create a situation where central bankers are now having to respond because of the impairment that such volatility would cause to the overall market participants? You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, and I agree that volatility will not go away. It will stay here. It's part of what Bitcoin is. And let's not forget that the stock market and especially the bond markets and a lot of other markets are less volatile because of the central bank, right? Mm-hmm. They step in, they rescue it, and that's they take out the volatility. And with it, they take out the returns. So Bitcoin feels like the only place in the world where capitalism or normal market behavior is still allowed. And yeah, I there will be a point when the market steps in, but it doesn't feel like this is now. It doesn't feel like the central bank will rescue Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, no, and I completely agree with that. I guess I'm just looking at the size. When we hit a trillion and it's dropped 50%, and you look at it just in the nominal terms of how much capital just disappeared, and you think about, all right, so the people that had these positions and the implications of their counterparty risk of their other positions, when does that start to become a factor that's going to have a much broader impact to the market is kind of my concern as I'm looking at this. And then how is that going to be received? Right. How's the rest of the market going to think about that?
I think that will be at a much higher market cap than 1 trillion. I think 1 trillion is still very, very small compared to the gold market, the bond market, stock markets. It's near to nothing. We'll have to grow, I guess, beyond the $10 trillion mark to really make a dent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I saw an interesting statistic. One of the big brand name kind of fund manager who has been recently interested in Bitcoin made the comment that, you know, in the 2017 run up and then the price falling back in 2018, 2019, that the on-chain data was suggesting that 86% of people just held right through it. They didn't sell any coins.
Yes. Yes. This was Stan Druckenmiller's comment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, you'd think, well, he was surprised by that, right? But I think, you know, people have a reason to fear being out of market. So, you know, before... Now, going back a few years, I had come to the realization, maybe 2014, something like that, that it wasn't that good an idea to day trade this thing, you know, to try and think, oh, I'll sell some now, I'll buy it back later, because basically looking at something very highly volatile, more so at that time, and plus or minus on some kind of exponential part of an S curve, and otherwise a random variable. So if you sell and buy back, the odds are stacked against you. And another statistic which highlights this, that if you eliminate the 12 single day largest gains in a year, Bitcoin loses money year on year. So your biggest risk is being out of market for any of those 12 days. And so, you know, simply buying more when it goes down, if you can afford that, or just hold, you know, put excess income if you have a job into it, that tends to work out very well over a long period of time. And certainly for myself, from 2017, I had come to the heuristic of buying anytime the price dropped by at least 20%. Below that, I didn't consider a dip. And so I bought my first post 20,000 at 16,000 and just kept buying down to 3,500. And I was kind of low on cash at that point, but you know, obviously, if you're still holding those today, that looks pretty good, right? So, I think the other thing is the, you know, you're talking about if, as the market gets bigger, how will it adapt to this? And I think the way it adapts is kind of biological or evolutionary, that people who can't handle it leave. They leave, you know, they put money in, the price drops, they sell at a loss, they panic sell. Maybe they learn not to do that in future when they see it come back, or maybe they don't, maybe they leave. But in any case, the coins just organically change hands to people who are inclined to hold them or who are better at managing risk. You know, if they're, you know, doing leverage or selling a bit and buying back. Another rule of thumb I use is if you are inclined to day trade, at least restrict yourself to 10% of coins. That way, if it all comes horribly unstuck, you'll still have 90% of the coins cold stored. So I think a lot of what happened in the last month is down to over leverage. And that we can talk about, but it creeps up on people faster than they think. So as Bitcoin gets bigger, you know, higher market cap, I do wonder if you would start to see more value investors. I mean, I tend to view it as a value investor, so the price falls, I try to buy more. And you see that with stocks, right? There are analysts who are looking at it and saying, well, this is overweight or underweight based on, you know, quarterly reports, expectations. And if it falls a bit, they will start to buy it with a fund or something, right? And so we might see some of that coming into Bitcoin in the longer term. If, you know, as more people gain confidence in the longer term trajectory, the long term viewpoint, the, you know, the volatility is normal, it's fine, it's necessary even, right? Otherwise, the price would already be much higher.
You know, Adam, you're hitting on a point that I think is so vital for people that are maybe getting into this for the first time, is they don't understand the conviction that's associated with people who hold a majority of the coins. It's not like that you have these fringe people that have a small position size that have this insane level of conviction. It's the people that have enormous stakes in it that have this level of conviction that as the price goes down 50%, they didn't even think about selling it. In fact, they were doing everything that they could to buy more. And so when we, if you look at the amount of coins that have been issued into the, through the protocol, and you take a percentage of that, of those coins, what percent of it is held by people with this deep, ridiculous conviction that are deep in the money and really aren't even fazed by a 50% drop? I would argue that that number is really high, like 80% or something of that magnitude.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is it doesn't have to even be the natural, you know, makeup of the average investor. It's just that those people are the survivors. Because if you don't take that attitude, you tend to get washed out, right? Or you panic, you would be inclined to sell in a dip or not buy in the first place because you're worried about volatility or something. So the people that either start out with this attitude or develop it over time, I think most people develop it over time. I think if basically your investment portfolio denomination changes, that's been my view for a long time now,
yeah,
that I want to increase the number of coins I have. And if the price is plus or minus 50%, I don't even account for it. Like, you know, one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. The question is, how do I get more Bitcoin without increasing risk that I might lose some of the Bitcoin I have got? And so that's where the, you know, leverage trading gets potentially dangerous if you overdo it, because it can, there's another saying, which is leverage can't make a bad investment good, but it can make a good investment bad, which is to say that you have something you long-term want to buy and hold, but if you over-leverage a price pullback that you would like to buy, kind of forces a sale to protect, you know, so that liquidation is partial or not full or something. Because if some people are doing quite high leverage, and that can like completely liquidate a portfolio basically or whatever's on exchange.
Yeah, maybe to add on I totally agree with the point you made earlier about holders with vision and great conviction. They're great holders. They are the holders you like to see in Bitcoin? And it's funny, I tweeted that the other day and got a lot of hate for that, that people who cannot afford or cannot stand the volatility, they shouldn't be there. You know, they shouldn't position themselves into a position that they can be shaken out against their will. And we all know those people that let's look at last 2 months when the price was 57,000, 60,000. I know personally a lot of people who entered the market, but who I could tell couldn't stand the minus 35, minus 50% drops. So when it happened, they chickened out the within a month, within 2 months. And that was really a lot of people. From on-chain, I guessed about $20 billion was lost by people who bought the month before. So that shows us that, I guess, the people with vision, the really long-term holders, they were okay until last month. And I would say March and April, because in those months we got so much people with high leverage, I guess, with no vision, that did not really understand Bitcoin, or at least not the low time preference that goes with it, that should go with it, and they sold. I have never seen it on chain, by the way, in any other month or year. So the holders that bought last 2 months are the weakest holders ever, that couldn't stand the volatility. And I agree. It's the volatility is part of the market. It's part of what makes Bitcoin great. And if you can't handle it, you will hurt yourself. So
be careful. Here's the other thing on top of that is, how many people did you talk to 2 months ago that said, I'm going to wait till I get a better buying opportunity because it's just so overheated. I'll buy it when there's the next dip. Well, now here's the dip. And you know exactly what they're doing is they're not buying because they're saying, well, it's probably the top happened and now it's going to keep going lower. And they'll just never get off their hands. And so what we're really talking about here, at least in my opinion, is what is the advice to somebody who wants to own Bitcoin, but can't, is just emotionally psyching themselves out. And, you know, I'm curious to hear your thoughts, but the only conclusion that I have come to is that people need to dollar cost average. They need to start off with smaller position sizes so that, you know, this insane volatility that you just naturally experience with Bitcoin isn't really a factor if it's, you know, a 1% or 2% position in your portfolio. It's not a big deal. And so if you're slowly just doing dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin over a year's period of time, like if you've been buying it slowly every month for the last year, you're way up, right? Even through this 50% drop that just happened. But I think most people just want to do their full position size all at once, and they want to get that perfect price, or they want to get a deal. And that's the thing that presents a really tough situation for people to be able to handle emotionally, especially if they don't have the knowledge or the conviction behind what's all going on behind the scenes with the protocol.
Yeah, I not to give any financial advice, of course, but in my opinion, the institutional investor mindset is great also for retail. And that is, if you decide upon vision and strategic analysis, some longer term thing that you want an exposure in a asset, say it's Bitcoin, then by all means, acquire that exposure, acquire that position, regardless of the price. Yes, dollar cost averaging, great way. Or do it small. Say, okay, I want a position. I want to be part of Bitcoin because I like the vision. I like where it's going in 5 or 10 years. And then you buy a really small stake. For one person, that's $1,000. For another, that's $1 million. But something that you're happy to lose, that you can afford to lose. And then don't look back. Give yourself the time to at least hold it for 4 years. Because nobody who held Bitcoin for 4 years had any loss at all. So yeah, I would, if you decided to make, to take a position to that you want to have exposure because you read the Bitcoin Standard and the white paper and did your research, by all means, don't look at the price. It doesn't matter. Just get the position. And really, if Bitcoin goes 5x or 10x, what does it matter if you bought for 30,000 or 60,000? It doesn't matter.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at Vacasa.com. That's Vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
So I want to just throw this out there because I think a lot of people don't understand necessarily how the derivatives market works. At least, you know, maybe people that are new to the space. And what we've seen over the last month and a half was just a cascading event of selling that was induced by people that had long positions, which is kind of ironic when you take a step back and you think about it, is these people that were selling were the ones that had an opinion that Bitcoin's going way higher. And they're the ones that supplied a large portion of the sell-off that happened. So I'm going to throw it over to you, Plan B, to kind of explain simply for people what causes this and what does it mean right now as we're going through a consolidation as well.
Yes, so derivatives markets are a phenomenon that is associated with mature markets. So only a spot market, it's not much. So you need futures markets, option markets, swap markets. And what those derivatives markets do is they divide the risk return profiles that are available in the spot market into two different risk return or more different risk return packages. So for example, with futures, you can do leverage on the one hand, and there were a lot of leverage longs of people that thought Bitcoin would go to 100,000 or more this month or next month. And you can do that with futures. And then there's the other side of the trade of people that say, well, I can provide you that leverage for a certain 30% or even 40% annualized return. And we were laughing about that the other day at the podcast with the three of us. Mm-hmm. Like, how can it be that there's 30, 40% Bitcoin neutral returns available in dollar terms? Well, that was because there's a lot of people that wanted to go leverage longs, long positions. And that, of course, can go wrong. It's very interesting to see the dynamics of that spread of the 30% being totally eliminated right now. It's zero and almost in backwardation in the future markets. But then you see in the option markets, you see the volatility coming back. So those are very attractive right now. Option prices are based on volatility and are another derivative that split the market in two parties, two or more parties. People don't want to bet that Bitcoin goes up or down, but don't want to have the other side of the trade. And the option providers, sellers that take the premium and make a very calculated bet. So I think derivatives markets are great as long as people that play on those markets know what they're doing. And obviously, in a maturing market like Bitcoin, I guess the leverage is a problem at the moment because, 100x leverage is like a certain loss. If you go 1% into the wrong direction, you're wiped out, and the odds of being wrong are 99.99%. So it's a certain win for the exchanges that provide 100x leverage, and it's a certain win for the people, who provide the other side of the trade. And I think that went horribly wrong last month.
Now, where we're at right now, with the price being low, and you have a ton of short sellers that are now entering into the market and taking their positions. And it's almost like you see the exact opposite of what we saw a month and a half ago with everybody going long. Now you have a pile of people going short, but these derivative products are not controlled. Like the underlying price is going to do what it does. And then the derivatives are going to react based on that underlying price. And so, when people see these big, massive green bars that explode up in what feels like minutes, and they're wondering, where did all these buyers come from? And the buyers came from the people that had an opinion that Bitcoin was going lower, and they basically up margin called, and they become forced buyers at that point. So right now, as we're seeing this price consolidation, are you seeing that plan B with the short sellers stepping into the market at scale that could potentially be the ones that provide the big green bars if the underlying starts to move upward?
Yeah, I see more the liquidation of the leverage longs more than the buildup of a leverage short position. But I'm sure there will be leverage shorts at the moment. And they will be liquidated too when we go up, as you say.
Yeah.
And it's because exactly what Adam said, because the money will go to the strongest hands and not to the gamblers that hit the 10x or 100x leverage button. Because in asset like Bitcoin, to trade that with leverage is as close to stupidity as one can come. And so you can see, I personally joke about it with friends, especially the institutional investor friends. It's like a tax on stupidity. So yeah, it will. So the good news then is that a lot of that money flows into the market to the strong hands. It sounds horrible when I say that, but that's just how it goes, right? All those people lose their money, especially the 100x traders, mm-hmm. and that money will be available for the other side of the trade. Mm-hmm. So will be a nice step up for another bull run or leg up, if you will. So yeah, I guess it's part of a ferociously capitalistic market without much interference of the governments. I sort of like it to see this market in its primitive and most pure form there is.
Yeah, I think many would even say that it's extremely healthy that this is allowed to happen. So just for some numbers here on all the exchanges, the open interest for futures only, was around $20 billion prior to at the beginning of May. And now you're down to $11 billion. So it's almost been cut in half the amount of futures open interest that's out there. Adam, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on some of these ideas with the derivatives.
Yeah, I mean, it's curious that probably, people think that the market fall is driven by panic sellers. So people who are trying to hold onto dollar value who didn't have to sell versus forced sellers. People who actually were, just desperately trying to accumulate more Bitcoin, but pushed it too hard on the leverage. And I'm thinking it may be more the latter than the former. So certainly some people will instinctively sell to preserve some dollar value. Maybe they'll think, this is too much for me, and they'll leave, or they'll hope to time it and buy back later, which is also dangerous, right? It can turn around in a heartbeat too. So certainly that statistic about the $20 billion down to $11 billion on, I presume that's the perpetual future open interest, is telling. And, just for some illustration of how the perpetual future is a kind of quadratic instrument. If you're trying to buy Bitcoin, more Bitcoin using Bitcoin, you've got a risk from the price falling when you're hoping it's going to go up, but you've got another compounding risk that makes it a squared loss, which is that the value of the collateral, i.e. the Bitcoin, is also falling. So you've got, so basically if you had 100 Bitcoins or 100 millibitcoins, 0.1 Bitcoin, same thing, just the ratio, right? So 100 units, and you go two times long, and the price starts at 50,000. By the time the price falls to 33,000, which is only a 33% fall, you'd be 100% liquidated on that position, right? So you think, well, two times. And if you look at the upside, it's not as great as you think, because you make a profit on the price increase, right? Mm-hmm. And then you want to convert that price increase into Bitcoin, and then you have to divide it by a new higher price. So the asymmetry is kind of not in your favor. And it's not that shorting is particularly safer. I mean, shorting Bitcoin is probably even more dangerous, if anything, because you have the same quadratic kind of effect in a way. If you are shorting with dollars, then your dollars are shrinking in relation to Bitcoin, so you have the quadratic effect. So I think actually most of the short interest in the market is not really short, it's the long short. It's a Bitcoin neutral way to collect yield, to lend money to people who are trying to go long, as Plan B was just saying. And so I think most of the short market is made up by that. So it's not actually exposed. And that is stable because, your bet in the price will go down, but if it goes up, the collateral increases and vice versa. So that's completely stable and won't get liquidated, generally speaking, in, a 10x increase or a 10x pullback. It's pretty stable. So go ahead.
Do you think that because this derivatives market was not mature during the last bull run. Now we're seeing all sort of like these perpetual futures contracts that you're talking about. This is something that's very unique to Bitcoin and the crypto economy that doesn't exist in your normal traditional markets. And you're able to do these perpetual futures contracts because of the 24/7 immediate clearing aspects that are inherently part of this, you know, this type of asset. And I guess my question is this: are we seeing the price perform differently, where there's a little bit less volatility in the momentum of the price action with systematic cascades, either up or down, that kind of happen more sporadically? Is that what's going to pop out of this derivatives, all these derivatives that are there now? Or do you think that that's just kind of what we've seen in the past year? Because to me, it seems like the price was way less volatile until we got just this super saturated long position, and then it was just this massive cascade of selling, which feels very different, and even in, as percentage wise is very different than the last cycle, because the last cycle the biggest drop you had was 38%, and now we've had one that was over 50. Is that the derivatives?
I mean, I don't know the full data, but it seems like it's a big factor, because you hear of people who've got liquidated. Probably everybody knows somebody who's had a overlong position, or like multiple positions, some of them liquidated, and that's typically it, right? They were holding and trying to increase their Bitcoin returns. And of course, since, you know, people have put on a long and got away with it, you know, without liquidation when the price was $10,000, are probably looking pretty good even today, right? And so there are some people who put these positions on and leave them for a long time, you know, hope to catch a wave, you know, price doubling. That gives them a lot of insulation where they can put a stop loss, which is still in the money somewhere in the market. So I think it's, in terms of how this works going forwards, I think that it's educational, like in a painful way, obviously, for many people, but they won't do that again, right? Or they'll start more cautiously. If they are using leverage, they'll use less of it, or they'll put stop losses, or paradoxically, maybe they will make higher leverage bets, but smaller ones that they can afford to liquidate. I mean, if you put on a 10x and it falls 10%, it's gone, right? It's mm-hmm. liquidated. So at least then, you know, I think professional traders in, let's say, Forex, leverage Forex trading, things like that, they're going to, you know, look at the news flow, make predictions, hope to be right, maybe 60% of the time, and make small bets, right? Lots of them. And so I think one of the mistakes is that people made large bets that became larger than they anticipated because this quadratic effect, which people don't think about, because when there are small movements, it's more linear. It gets more quadratic as you get further down or further up. So yeah, I think that there are people who stepped in to buy coins, certainly when the market hit the 31,000, around about there. Oh, I happened to be looking at the market when that was going on, and it was insane. You know, the price was jumping 1,000 or 2,000 every few seconds, just jumping around as people were getting liquidated and other people were buying. So I think there's got to be some coin transfer. You know, every sale has a matching buyer, and some of those buyers won't be as leveraged, or won't be leveraged, or will be start better or become better at managing risk and having stop losses and smaller position sizes and things like that.
So plan B, my question for you is just, when you're looking at the on-chain data, what kind of indicators are you seeing right now as far as, you know, where we might be heading moving forward, what we just saw? Kind of give us a snapshot of how you're reading the data right now.
Sure. To go one step back to your previous question about derivatives markets and did it change the price? I honestly don't think it did change that much in the price dynamics. Because if I look at, for example, April 2013, the price in the 2013 bull run hit $140 at that time. Mm-hmm. And then 4 months later, in July 2013, it hit at the lowest point 63. Mm-hmm. 140 to 63. So it went down more than 50%. So we also had that in the early days, those big price jumps. And maybe derivatives markets exaggerated and increase those swings. I don't know. It looks just looking at the data, it looks like the same thing. But nothing abnormal there. If I look at the on chain data is very interesting at the moment, and there's lots of people doing it, like Clement, Willy Wu, and the Glassnode guys. It's really a growing space, and it's very interesting. What I see is two things, basically. First of all, we don't see a lot of volume, a lot of transactions that are normally there at bull markets, at the end of the bull market, like the 2017 and 2013 bull market. And without being specific about what kind of transactions those are, but just picture the volume, some volume of transactions is just not at that level. We're about halfway. So that gives me an indication that we're not in the upper part of the bull market yet, more like halfway. And then if we look at this, the spend, the coins that are spent on chain, and of course we know all, the complete UTXO set is there to be analyzed for us. So we know every UTXO, when it was created, what the price was at the moment, et cetera, et cetera. So you know how much is sold or bought, but especially sold with a loss, and how much is sold at a profit. And this month was the first month in quite some time that the net effect of all the UTXOs that were sold is a loss, a big loss. Mm-hmm. That was not present in 2017. There were no loss months in 2017, but there was a big loss month in 2013. Mm-hmm. So the plateau and the jump from 140 to 64 that I just described in that same period, a lot of coins or UTXOs were sold at a loss on chain. Mm-hmm. So, that leads me to the conclusion that either we are halfway, sort of like 2013, and the biggest jump is still to come, because in 2013 it jumped all the way from 62 to 1,000, right, or even 1,100 even, mm-hmm. or this was it, this was the bull run, we're now entering more months of selling at a loss, and that will be. Well, the end of stock to flow model for one, but then we'll have to wait till another bull market, which probably would be there after the next halving. But I guess you know which scenario I prefer. I don't believe at all that that 60,000 was the top and that this was the bull market, because I think we're in a 2013 kind of scenario, and the best is yet to come.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this: it's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4x points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The Investors Podcast Network is launching something new that hasn't been offered in years. It was very popular when we offered it years ago, and we're bringing it back again. We've launched a new stock investing course that dives deep into the first principles of sound investment strategies and explores a variety of relevant investing topics, ranging from the fundamental differences between active and passive investors, how to build and monitor a stock portfolio, tips for optimizing your retirement savings, and much more. For a limited time, all We Study Billionaires listeners get 15% off with the code WSB15 when you visit theinvestorspodcast.com/stock course. That's code WSB15 at theinvestorspodcast.com/stock course, or simply click the link in the show notes for this episode.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, I wonder if the asymmetry of buying power is part of it. So, because the market is generally very net long and people don't like to be net short Bitcoin, the sort of buying power left on platforms is, you know, there's not that much reserve dollars to buy coins, and buying coins using leverage is itself risky. So it makes, you know, unlike, and people who are interested in Bitcoin tend to end up very exposed. They don't have cash reserves because they'd sooner redenominate in Bitcoin. So you don't have that kind of market maker sort of value investor phenomena where there are, let's say, mutual funds and so on that are looking at analyst reports and buying undervalued stocks that they think have long-term value. So you do have some new parts of that, which is the institutional investors coming in, and you know, you would expect them to be less phased and more long-term looking to be accumulating at this point, but that remains to be seen, I guess. And otherwise, I just think that, you know, generally some people use leverage to buy lower down, so that the leverage hasn't gone away, right? It's just shrunk. So probably some of that bought the 30,000, 35,000 range on lower leverage or something. So I assume that it will, you know, now that some of that risk has been moved from the system and coins transferred hands, that things will, you know, gradually get more solid and pullbacks less rare, as they're more rare.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. If we look at the last couple of months, it was basically Elon Musk and Tesla buying Bitcoin. And then a lot of people copied that behavior. They also thought, well, if Elon is doing it and Tesla is doing it, then, well, we go in as well. And then Elon quit and did the energy fund thing, and he quit. And then those people stepped off the train again. So I guess the whole reason to buy Bitcoin because Elon Musk did it, or that was some kind of sign that other companies would buy and follow Tesla as well. That story came up and went down. We left that behind us. And now I totally agree with you that the army of holders that held through this event, again, this FUD, Energy FUD Tesla event, and held through so much more of these events, they will be the strong base of the next leg up, because they don't sell. They don't even, like yourself, don't count in dollars anymore. They want to have more Bitcoins. So they make use of this dip like a real value investor, and they say, thank you very much, Elon Musk and Elon Musk copycats. We're here for the long run and not for a quick buck in 1 or 2 months. So yeah, it's very Bitcoin for sure is stronger now than it was 4 months ago.
Elon apparently didn't actually sell the coins, or at least the ones that are on the balance sheet of Tesla, I guess, right? Because it's a public market company. He commented he didn't sell. So, But I'm not sure that institutional buying is, you know, people form opinions based on little snippets of news, and the media likes to amplify negative news or make it up or recycle it. And, you know, there's a lot of confusion, like the assumptions that people make about news are wrong. And for example, the mining thing that we talked about last time, that, you know, that the hash rate was down a large amount and it wasn't, they were looking at, you know, the effective extrapolated there, and that that would hurt miners outside China, and it actually helped them. And so, you know, the inferences are very confused and wrong. So if people trade them, that's kind of giving value to people who understand the market structure better. And I think that, you know, negative news sells, so news organizations will recycle old information that isn't even new, or, you know, China is a good one for it because of the language barrier. Sometimes people, you know, mistranslate things or amplify things, and then there's nobody really stepping up to explain what really happened. But the institutional buyers, I think they are still there coming, because it takes people may be not familiar with how long it takes these entities to get to a position. And they've got to do lots of tax planning, legal planning, and get external advice from, you know, auditors and regulatory lawyers, and figure out how best to hold it. And maybe that involves, you know, board approvals for a public market company. And, you know, in the case of even MicroStrategy, right, he went to quite elaborate lengths to protect the company from adverse reactions by offering a share buyback for anybody who didn't, you know, like the strategy. So all those things take, you know, months and months, maybe 6 months or a year to set up. And if you recall, going back a while ago, MicroStrategy organized an institutional buyers kind of private conference or something, and there were, you know, hundreds and hundreds of company participants. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, certainly companies can turn out to have weekends too, but they're at least operated on a 5-year time horizon plus. And the other thing that's kind of surprising about time horizons is, if you would buy, you know, stock market, just stocks, like a stock index or individual stocks in sectors, any financial advisor would tell you, well, don't buy that if you need the cash for, you know, 3 years plus, right? You should expect to hold it, because the market has cycles, it can be volatile. It does well in the long term, but in the short term, it may go down. That kind of advice that people give out. And yet it's Bitcoin, and they're selling, you know, barely a month after they bought it. So I don't know what they were thinking, really. I mean, this in the Bitcoin space, it's sort of similar to the stock situation in having cycles, but just much, you know, a higher Sharpe ratio and a volatility to go with it. So if you adapt for that, you know, divide everything, divide the Sharpe ratio by 10, volatility by 10, it's something very similar, right? So I don't see, you know, people should catch up and learn that. It just takes a while to adapt to, you know, this kind of volatility and understand that that actually is something that is storing value for you over the long term, right? I guess it seems counterintuitive.
I can confirm the institutional buying behavior, by the way. It takes ages before you get past compliance and accounting and legal, etc. And then for sure, they will, when they did the whole process and they made the decision, the strategic decision to acquire an exposure, they will do it. So they will not be influenced by news or something else, FUD or whatever. They just made the decision and execute the decision. And that will take probably also days or at least weeks to acquire a big, say, billion-dollar chunk of Bitcoin without moving the price. And that, by the way, is also a very interesting fact that if, for example, MicroStrategy bought, like, what is it, $2 billion? And he was very detailed, Michael Saylor, about how he did it. He acquired that position without moving the price very much. And it can be done, right, by buying very small parts over a long period of time, so you don't influence the price. The price action that we saw last month, and especially this month, the down action was always in the China, in the illiquid hours of the market. So it was deliberately destructive. It was not sold by someone who wanted the most dollars for his Bitcoin. It was sold at illiquid times in the market with far too big of a chunks to get a good price. So it was destructive selling, and that is very, very interesting for me. And actually, if you look at the price charts, for example, the daily chart for the last couple of months, you see that all this destructive selling, all this selling, which, by the way, took place at the end of each month, strangely, all that selling was bought within 1 or 2 weeks. So it was like a V-shaped recovery within 2 weeks. And that also is, for me, a bit of a hallmark of institutional selling, that they scare people out of their positions, even
institutional selling or buying,
because they together with their OTC desks scare retail and normal people out of their positions, even liquidate people out of their positions, and then buy the scraps in the weeks after it, and that is especially effective if you sell and push the price down in illiquid hours and then buy the stuff at liquid hours in small chunks. So, and that is basically what I'm seeing since January. So last 5 months. And that's very, very bullish in my eyes. So I wouldn't be surprised if this leg down in May would be bought up in June again. And especially since it's now the beginning of the month again, which is a pattern that has been present for 5 months already. Very interesting. Maybe random, but
Are they going to do that strategy? Would they have to do it when they're buying? Would they have to buy in the derivatives market long in order to offset the selling that they're having to do in the underlying?
No. They just buy spot, but small amounts, like Michael Saylor explained.
Okay, I'm with you now. So they're leveraging the lack of liquidity to drive the price lower in that short term, and then they're trying to scoop up in the morning hours in New York or whatever.
Right. Gotcha. Right. And they combine the pushing down of price with big orders in illiquid times. They combine it with FUD. So news stories that the mainstream media will talk about the day after. And you know, this is not conspiracy. I've seen it with my own eyes. Whenever a large party buys something or wants to buy something, there's a whole playbook of how they're going to buy it, how they're going to acquire that exposure. And it goes with a communication plan. So the FUD, if you buy something, you want to buy it cheap. So you want to have FUD in the market when you buy it. And that's I think, nothing secret or... I saw a lot of people talk about this, especially the last couple of weeks. People from the scene, they recognize Goldman Sachs, Morgan Sachs, everybody is doing this. That's why you buy those banks, right? That's what they do. They create FUD and they create they acquire the position for you. And I guess the OTC desks, the Bitcoin OTC desks, are very professional ex-investment bankers that know the play.
Hey, Adam, I wanted to ask you about some of the information about China mining and how a lot of it's migrating here to North America. What kind of inside info do you have on some of the mining rigs leaving China? I know the China news story that came out was absolutely recycled FUD, but is there anything that is happening over there that's suggesting that the Chinese are putting a kibosh on a lot of this stuff?
I mean, it's happened multiple times before, so it's always difficult to take it seriously, you know, because we'll have the China bans Bitcoin or China bans mining or China bans I don't know, exchange trading or something. And I think maybe some of it is context related. So people look at it from the point of view of the regulatory environment they're used to living in. And they think, well, you know, if our regulator said that, we would have to do something, take it seriously. But in China, the sort of regulations are handled differently. So effectively, you know, you need permissions to do many things, but you can't get the permissions. So everything is kind of in the gray zone. And then they make announcements to kind of soft tune what's happening on the ground. So if they think that something is getting too big that they'd sooner shrink, they'll say something negative. And so generally speaking, things just flow around it like water, like they will, you know. So there's definitely a bit of news about people trying to look for hosting and power outside of China. I recall in a previous version of this a few years ago, the story was that some miners had secured power in Russia and driven equipment and trucks over the Russian border and like set up shop over the border. But it seems like nevertheless, a lot of hash rate continues in China. So I wouldn't be surprised if that plays out this time. Some may relocate, and generally there has been a bit of a trend towards North America and Europe over the last few years, without, you know, much fanfare, just because I guess institutional investors doing mining are a bit more savvy about geopolitical risk. So they will say, you know, okay, that 70 cents per kilowatt hour, but under what conditions, right? You know, are you using air filtration? What's the electrical safety like? You know, what's the chances that the mine will catch fire? And what's the political overhang? You know, are you, you know, is there a chance that the local or national regulator could change the power price without notice or ask you to leave and, you know, ask you to stop mining in its jurisdiction? So those sort of more sophisticated investors look at the non-pure price factor, right? So they look at the quality and the political risk. And so that, I think, drove, you know, organically meant that hash rate grew faster outside of China. So that's changed the balance a bit. And there does seem to be, you know, people looking to move equipment, but I don't know how much, you know, spare capacity is just kicking around. You know, somebody says they want, you know, tens of per hash of, or hundreds, even exahash of miners to move, you know, people are building just in time because it's capital intensive. So it can't move that quickly. It takes time to build infrastructure, and they would be talking about, you know, moving it within a few months. So I guess between the lines, it won't actually move instantly. We'll see. We'll certainly get a view on it, right? If you look at the hash rate, and if it goes down and stays down, that's because people can either mine it or move it, relocate it fast enough. So we'll see how it plays out. But it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, I guess the point, because people hear this and it sounds alarming, but I mean, ultimately, you know, Bitcoin doesn't care. Sounds callous, but it really doesn't. You know, the difficulty will go down. Mining will become more profitable for people outside of the jurisdiction that's affected. And, you know, there was already a shortage of miners. So if some of it's sold, you know, that alleviates some of that shortage, because it's difficult to buy used equipment because you don't know how it's been treated, right? If it's been air filtered or overheated, overclocked, etc. So that's tricky.
Speaking of another topic that I don't think Bitcoin cares, let's talk about the energy discussion, because I mean, this is getting a lot of attention in the media. I'm just kind of curious to hear both of your thoughts on it and kind of where you stand.
Well, I mean, I think there is, I mean, people are not so familiar with the energy sector in general, but the, you know, the total amount of power in the world that is consumed by Bitcoin is quite small. And Bitcoin miners tend to want cheaper power. And so that tends to be renewable, just because there's no, you know, extraction, refining, and transport costs for the fossil fuels that are the alternative. And so, and the other thing that really favors kind of green or renewable energy for mining is that it's very location independent. So for general power infrastructure, it's going to be around population centers, around, you know, heavy industries, and Bitcoin can be anywhere, right? So that's partly how it ended up being in these remote areas of China, because due to the efficiencies of central planning, they massively built out hydro dams where there are no humans and no industry. And so they were just sitting there with the water pouring downstream, right? Because there was nowhere, you can't just generate electricity and not use it. You have to send it somewhere. So they were just underused massively. So, you know, and people are engaging in extremely bad data science when they throw out metrics. You know, they'll take the amount of hash rate that they estimate is from a country using crude methods, and then they'll multiply it by that whole country's average source of energy, even though it's predominantly green because it's cheaper and unused. So they'll just throw out bad data. Another interesting data point, which we know firsthand, is in the Quebec province of Canada, which we have a data center in Montreal, in the Quebec province. There's 37 gigawatts of hydropower, most of which is unused. And so, you know, that one province in one country could fully power the Bitcoin network. Like that's a multiple of the entire Bitcoin network. So just a bit of context. Another thing about power is there's an enormous amount of wastage. So, you know, power that doesn't end up getting used. Power stations take a delay to power up and power down in response to demand. The excess is just, you know, people are paid negative energy rates to get rid of the excess power because they can't balance it fast enough. So in aggregate, it's a very inefficient thing and improving over time as people get, you know, more renewables and nuclear actually, power infrastructure online. So I generally view that Bitcoin is actually a net positive for development of green infrastructure because it gives a steady base load that can be turned off on demand, which is excellent for funding infrastructure like projects, because, you know, they have to make it. I mean, you know, people have a political will to see green power in the world, but you have to convert that into finance, right? Somebody has to come up with billions of dollars to build new dams and so on. And those are done using project financing. And the project financing wants a business case to say, well, okay, we'll finance this billion-dollar dam, but how are you going to, you know, pay it back? And if the way they're going to pay it back is heavy industry and there's no industry and there's no population there, they're going to say no. But if you have, you know, a long-term contract for mining, Bitcoin mining, and that can, you know, provide, that can supplement or subsidize the infrastructure, and then, you know, the industrial and residential demand is variable. You know, you get a heat wave and the power use goes up. And that's what happened in Texas earlier this year. They had like kind of rolling blackouts because I guess there was a heat wave and everybody turned up their air conditioners and overloaded the grid. And so, you know, if you saw more Bitcoin funded grid infrastructure in Texas, you know, residential prices are usually much higher than Bitcoin prices. So it would just, people would turn off, you know, some percentage of the Bitcoin mining and there'd be no power blackouts. So I think that's the future. The other thing is that, in my opinion, you know, civilization has followed a long arc of becoming, it's basically driven by energy, right? So I think the future ultimately will involve more infrastructure. There's this kind of metric called the Kardashev type one metric, which is some kind of, you know, civilization metric, which we haven't reached yet, which is, you know, extracting a decent proportion of the energy that lands on the planet via solar radiation and other sources. And there's an enormous amount of untapped, even just not built, but even use of existing, you know, as the Quebec province case shows. So, and actually the Quebec province is an interesting one because there is an interest from miners to mine in that province, but politics got in the way. So actually, you know, sometimes politicians become active in proposing a positive social agenda, but often they get in the way. They're sort of gritting the gears and they prevent industry from solving problems. And this is one of them, right? So certainly we as a company were intending to expand in that region, but ended not being able to because the politicians kind of, it was an election year and they made a mess of it, basically.
Yeah, well, I'm not an energy expert, but it reminds me very much about the energy FUD that was used in the, against the internet back in the day, 20 years ago. There was a lot of energy FUD about the internet and how much coal and carbon dioxide it would use, et cetera. But it's like today, the people that use that energy FUD are mostly people that don't understand or don't see any value in Bitcoin at all. So any energy that is used on Bitcoin is too much, and they just don't see the added value on the other side. And I think that's where the biggest problem is. But the energy FUD currently that it's used against Bitcoin is a bit dangerous, I think, because it very quickly leads into the discussion that we should go from proof of work to proof of stake. And that is a very dangerous, attack vector. That's how I see it, because proof of work is essential. It's in Bitcoin. It's one of the essential ingredients, and everybody who understands Bitcoin knows that. But if you don't, most people cannot even read the white paper. Those people are very, vulnerable for falling for this FUD and also the altcoin FUD that there's coins that are green and that use proof of stake instead of proof of work. So the whole proof of work, proof of stake thing is a nasty side effect of that. And I guess we're not done with the energy FUD discussion because it will be kept alive.
Explain real fast for people from your point of view, why the proof of work versus proof of stake is so important.
Yeah, I'll do that very quickly because Adam Beck can do this 10 times better than I, of course. But me as a ordinary investor and not a programmer nor a cryptographer, I understand that Bitcoin, the peer-to-peer network, needs something to make sure that every peer-to-peer decentralized node, like my own node, knows which block it should add to the it can add to the database, because we have a synchronized database peer-to-peer, but everybody can shoot in blocks and transactions. But how do I know that it's a right block without a central party like a bank or a server or some company like with Ethereum or Ripple? How do I know the block that I got fed is okay and I can add it to my blockchain? And that's the proof of work, the hash that is valid and also has a correct number of leading zeros. And proof of stake doesn't have that. You cannot validate the block and add the block to your blockchain just by getting the block. You have to have additional information from validator nodes some kind of server, the biggest stakeholders, proof of stake, that tell you, okay, this one is correct and this one is not. So, yeah, that's how I see it. I see it as an essential part of Bitcoin, and without it, I couldn't build my blockchain peer to peer.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways I find the argument to be more economic than technical, which is it may be a sort of fundamental need for hard money to have a cost of production. Things which don't have a cost of production end up being politically sought after. And then, resources are expended currying political favor. So basically the Cantillon effect, bribery, corruption, wars, and lobbying. So all of those things can consume resources too, but in an ugly, unproductive way. So, if a Bitcoin is valued at 30,000, 50,000, whatever the value is, then people can economically spend up to that marginal value in chasing, you know, receiving an additional coin. So they will spend it on equipment and power infrastructure and electricity. And if it were just handed out to, you know, a federation, I mean, I think of the proof of stake as basically a federation, you know, it's just a group of businesses or something, which is an okay structure, but you don't really need a stake. And I think stake makes it worse because then it's vulnerable to somebody amassing more money and gaining more influence and control over the allocation of new money that enters the system. So it ends up sort of looking similar to the current system, either a fiat system with central banks and quantitative easing, all this kind of stuff. And I think that's how you end up with these very unpredictable supply curves for various coins. So I think monetary economists will tend to view predictability as an important factor, like that the supply curve is very predictable. In the case of gold, it's reactive to price. You know, people will ramp up production if the price is high. In Bitcoin, that doesn't happen because of difficulty adjustment. So I think it's kind of fundamental. Well, the other thing is it doesn't, incrementally it costs less because coins were mined faster at the beginning when the price was low, and that factor is continuing, you know, due to the stock to flow ratio, that the number of new coins per halving is shrinking. So, you know, ultimately when most of the coins are in circulation, it wouldn't have cost a very big portion of the value to extract them. And I think, you know, people don't bemoan gold production costs very much, but that's, you know, a very industrial process in itself. Is, you know, the value of having hard money is very useful for society. And the other thing is, I think that Bitcoin as a savings technology has pushed people towards paying more attention to saving who would otherwise be inclined to spend. Many people are sort of very consumerist, right? They spend plus or minus everything they receive, they spend, or they take credit and then they spend. And so some societies are heavier on saving, where they'll save 90% of their income. Others are, you know, spend 90% of their income. And so Bitcoin tends to push people more towards saving because they can, in a more, in a much stronger sense than with compound investing in, you know, bonds or stock markets, they can see that the saving will have a higher value later. So this time preference argument. And so the argument there is, if, you know, money comes from somewhere, so the money spent on buying Bitcoin and indirectly on Bitcoin mining, in the alternative would have gone in buying, you know, consumer goods that have a lot, don't last very long and end up in landfills. And so, you know, the industrial production cost of all those goods that filled up landfills, and now, you know, that part of the, you know, to the extent that Bitcoiners make up part of the world's economy, the world has become less throwaway consumerist and filling up landfill. And, you know, many consumer goods are made from petrochemicals, plastics, and industrial processes and so on. So I think for that reason also, Bitcoin is probably already a net positive just from that factor.
Adam, I've tried to make the argument that when you look at the Lightning Network, it's automatically providing a proof of stake type system, but with the where it's a little bit different is anybody can run a full node, and you don't have to actually stake coins in order to provide a node into that network of the consensus that's happening on the Lightning Network. That's where it's a little bit different than, call it, Ethereum's proof of stake kind of model. So you get the added energy benefits, or the reduction of energy expense in order to confirm transactions between individuals that really don't need the level of security that you have on the layer one, but you're getting it at a significant reduction in energy. And I think when we would warp ourselves 10, 15, 20 years into the future, and you look at where most of your transactions are going to be occurring, I would suspect a significant portion of the transactions are going to be actually conducted on the Lightning Network and not on chain. Only your large, substantial transactions would be on chain. So are we effectively getting proof of stake in a way that it doesn't come with the setbacks that are associated with proof of stake by having the Lightning Network?
Well, I mean, certainly Bitcoin layer twos don't, they don't produce coins, right? They are just layer twos. So I saw that somebody from, I think it's PayPal, commented the difference between in the Elon's thread. You know, they came out and said, well, you know, the current chief architect at PayPal or something said, well, at PayPal, we know the difference between settlement networks and payment networks. So I think you could make that argument for Bitcoin that, you know, the different layers are not resulting in new coins being created. I think another confusion, because the media likes to sensationalize, is the cost per transaction, which is actually close to zero in effect. Like, you know, an empty block, okay, the miners don't get the transaction fees, but, you know, most of the value is actually the freshly mined coins, and people have a choice of layer twos. So if they are paying for layer one transactions, it's because they find them sufficiently valuable, right? That they want to do cold storage, or they want to do a transaction which is harder to censor. And the Bitcoin main chain has, you know, fundamental advantages. So they're paying for something they value, but incrementally, you know, if a block has got one more or less transaction in it, it doesn't change the cost of mining it, right? So, you know, at least for the midterm, the idea that it costs so much, you know, dollars or kilowatts to mine it, to do a transaction is not really a usable metric, because the blocks will get produced anyway. Some portion of them are actually empty for technical reasons. And as you were alluding to, the layer twos have a massive multiplying effect. And in a way, you know, there are kind of informal IOU type of transaction systems, i.e. the trading inside exchanges. I mean, there are coins changing hands very rapidly at a massive multiple of what happens on chain, and even credit arrangements between exchanges and institutional traders and so on means that there are coins moving around that don't reflect on the chain. So those you have a trust element, but, you know, the layer twos like Lightning and Liquid improve that, you know, to not single trust.
I think that's where my frustration comes with a lot of the energy articles and the FUD that's out there, is they're looking at the amount of transactions that are happening on layer one. They're saying to for this to become a global transaction layer, this is how many transactions would have to happen globally. And when we look at how much, you know, that would cost on layer one, the number is this high, which is, you know, all the countries on the planet times 10 of their current energy levels. And I'm just like rolling my eyes, and I'm saying, these people have no technical understanding of what's being built on top of this, which is going to handle that throughput, which is going to be a majority of the transactions. And then when you do look at what will happen on chain and the cost of that, I think it's going to be, you know, not anything near what these projections of these energy articles are saying, because they just don't understand what's being constructed from a technical standpoint on top of the layer one.
Yeah, I'm really smirking over here for the audience. We won't be able to see, but, you know, the level of understanding is like childlike and just ridiculous. I mean, you know, they'll make arguments that basically misunderstand supply and demand, or assume that you scale networks by, you know, saturating the internet with, you know, microtransactions. And like, no network ever was built like this. You know, I mean, even the Starlink satellite network is not a broadcast network, right? It's got lots of routing within it, many downlinks, thousands of laser links between satellites. And if you converted the whole network into a single broadcast massive Wi-Fi hub, it's transaction throughput. I mean, it's kind of data throughput, it's latency, it's efficiency in terms of dropping data because too many devices are trying to talk at the same time, would just fail. I mean, it would be thousands of times less efficient, just fundamentally so. And it's not, people will throw out the argument, computers get faster each year and all this kind of stuff. But, the speed of light doesn't get faster each year. And at no point does it make sense to throw money away. So, people are using more bandwidth every year too for high fidelity video streaming, real-time interactive things. So, the demand for bandwidth and storage is insatiable. So at any point, switch networks will win. And I don't understand why anybody with any kind of basic understanding of how things work would imagine that Bitcoin should be different. I mean, it's just shocking how people get such strong opinions about, very basic facts about networks, like any network, the internet, like Starlink, GSM networks, radio networks, they all have layers and routing.
Do you think that the adoption or the incentive structure for Lightning adoption will go up when the price of Bitcoin gets a lot higher and your person who's trying to have a small coffee-sized level transaction has no incentive whatsoever to settle that on chain because of the cost of the fees that would be associated with it, which would force them down into Lightning. So like I had a conversation with Will Reeves over at Fold, and I'm just looking at what he's doing. And so he has all these people, various levels of payments in Bitcoin rewards. And like, I'm thinking, if he's trying to send all those out via on-chain layer one transactions, like the fees associated with that are tremendous. They're huge. And, as a person who has rewards with him, if I could take those rewards over Lightning, I absolutely would, because A, I could do it immediately. And two, he wouldn't assess any type of fee to me in order to receive those rewards. And so in the back of my mind, I'm thinking it seems like the incentive structure isn't necessarily there yet, but give it another 3 or 4 years, the incentive structure to build out Lightning for a lot of these payment vendors and people that are providing these types of services where people have maybe not a significant amount, but they have a small amount and they don't want to be dealing with fees all the time. It's going to force feed the further Lightning adoption. Is that how you see it, or am I way off basis here?
No, I mean, I think that like other networks, you end up with different protocols for different applications. So like the internet, you have voice over IP, video streaming, web, and so on. And they're optimized for different use cases. And certainly for retail and micropayment, Lightning is just better. I mean, it's making a trade-off, so it's not as good for kind of security, hot wallet risk, but for other factors like speed of finality is almost instant, the fee structure, the scalability is much better. And we're seeing a bit of that with Liquid as well, which is a kind of sidechain type of layer two. So it doesn't involve channels, but in the same way as Lightning, you can move funds in and out of it. That it's, people use technology for what they want to use it for, despite the thought processes of the people who build it. And we were certainly thinking the Liquid will be interesting for traders because it offers advantages to them. But organically, we're seeing a lot of people use it for just medium-sized payments because it's cheaper and faster and has confidentiality. So, I don't think it's done as well. I mean, I think there will be more layer twos and the technology will improve over time. There are more being developed. There's the so-called state chain. There are people working on that nowadays. So
Adam, I've never used Lightning. I'm kind of curious if I have, I think you guys have a wallet called Liquid. Is that, what's the wallet? Aqua.
Yeah.
Sorry. You have a wallet called Aqua that I know you can put liquid assets on. So walk a person through, like, if I was going to download this app and I wanted to purchase, one of these assets, talk us through what that process would be like from a user experience.
I mean, the exchanges and payment processors and kind of simple swap services will let you swap Bitcoin for liquid Bitcoin. And liquid has other assets. It also has US dollar tethers and euros and different assets. So you would just, I mean, the user experience is very like Bitcoin. You know, you set up a seed, you use QR codes to send and receive. So it's very Bitcoin-like experience. Plus, then you have, the transactions are a bit faster because the blocks are every minute instead of being, you know, randomly distributed around a 10-minute mark. And two blocks is actually final for some technical reasons. Of course, it has trade-offs, right? As with Lightning, the censorship resistance is not as good. And so I would say, for cold storage, you should move funds onto the main chain. And it seems like some people are doing that. You know, they'll sort of do their dollar cost average stacking into liquids. And then, you know, once a quarter or once in a while, when they're built up enough, they'll convert it and put it in cold storage on the main chain. So that's another use case.
But you're having to go to an exchange in order to procure these. You're not doing this on the app, right?
There's another wallet called Sideswap. It's by a company called Sideswap Limited. And they have, for Android and iOS, a smartphone app that lets you swap in-app. So you can swap main chain Bitcoin for liquid Bitcoin, and you can swap the other direction. And you can swap dollars, tethers for liquid Bitcoin, actually in a trustless way. So it's a kind of atomic swap. And so that seems to have captured a lot of people's imagination. They're building up, more user-originated swaps where you can sort of place orders in it and be the provider. So at the moment, they're the middleman, but they are in a trustless way. So you can, that kind of thing is possible too, and presents a nicer user experience because you have one app that can do both.
All right. That's all the questions that I have for you guys. I really appreciate you guys taking time to do this again. I know the last one that we had, we got a lot of incredible feedback from folks that really kind of enjoying the conversation. So I appreciate your time. Both of you guys, give folks a handoff where they can learn more about you.
So on Twitter, it's Adam3US, and for the Blockstream related products, it's at Blockstream.
Okay, and I'm on Twitter under Plan B at 100 trillion USD. That's 100 trillion USD. And I have a website, it's planbtc.com. All the articles and previous interviews are on there. If you're interested in it, please have a look.
Hey, so thanks for everybody listening into the show. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe to the show on whatever podcast app you're using. We really appreciate that. And if you have time, leave us a review. So thanks for joining us this week, and we'll catch you next Wednesday.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.